Okay. Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. We welcome you to the House Committee on Revenue. Representative Comp, you have some visitors here today. Perhaps you'd like to introduce them, please.
Yes, I would like to welcome to the committee and people in the audience two students from Parrish Middle School, and they're standing up there in the back. And it's Jesus Romero. And Jesus, are you 7th or 8th grade?
8th.
8th grade. And Belen Morales.
7th
grade. And they're back there working for me right now. They're busy translating some information from English to Spanish.
Excellent. Are all the youngsters in Parrish this good looking?
Yes.
Well,
no.
They said yes. You said yes.
Well, and the other thing, too, both the students told me, one of them has just been here in America for 3 years and the other one for 4 years, and their English is very good, much better than my Espanol.
Very good. Thank you very much. And we wish you bienvenidos. So, colleagues, today we'll have public hearings, possible work sessions on a couple of bills. Then we have 2451, which we're going to have additional work up on. I'm being told that in our house the rules are that if you don't finish a bill on the day that you take it up, we can't use the Ways and Means rule, and that is to post it for the next day for a bill that's in process. We've got the 48-hour posting notice. And that being the case, be aware that what's going to happen is that as we get going in this process, and we'll be back to full two-hour schedules next week, as we get going in this process, you might be packing down a whole fistful of bills that are scheduled for 3 days, but you may only actually hear a portion of those on any one of those days. So I apologize for that, but that's the rules under which we live. So with that, we're going to go ahead and open up a public hearing on House Bill 2448. And we invite Paul, if you'd like to tell us about 2448.
Chair, I'll let Elizabeth do that.
Oh, okay. Thank you. And Deborah, if you'd like to come forward, you're welcome to do that. We've got you here for a little bit anyway, so you can make yourself comfortable up in the front. Thank you very much, Deborah, for coming. Oh, okay. Okay. And so your thought is to do that first.
Okay.
You know, we'll do it, Bob. We'll do it. I'm going to then open the public hearing on 2451 as well and invite Bob to go ahead.
Chairman Butler and committee members, for the record, I'm Elizabeth Martin-Mahar with the Legislative Revenue Office. So I'll start with House Bill 2451 and just give you a brief overview here. And basically, we just have a staff measure summary. The revenue impact will be coming, but there also will be some additions and changes. So what the bill currently does as it is written, it requires the $6,000 of earned income to qualify for the working family child care tax credit to come from Oregon sources only.
But Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative Boquist.
We're talking about 2351?
2451.
2451.
2451. Okay. That's the last bill on today's agenda.
Okay, so with House Bill 2451, we're talking about the working family child care tax credit. We're talking about some changes that are going to be made to the requirements in order to qualify for that credit. And under current law, it's $6,000 of earned income, but this is really indexed to inflation. So roughly now here in 2005, it's $6,900 as far as minimum income that has to be earned for a taxpayer to be able to qualify. But right now, under current law, there's no requirement as far as where that income comes from. Okay, it doesn't say Oregon only, and that's what we're adding in here. It has to be now that at least that $6,000 comes from Oregon sources. So that is kind of the question then that was posed by the Department of Revenue, was to look at whether or not you wanted like non-residents to be able to qualify for this. Maybe they didn't have any earned income here in Oregon, but all of their income was somewhere else. Then that was something that they wanted you to make sure that was the policy choice that you wanted to have. So basically it's dealing with putting in Oregon sources only. And the other issue that's being brought forward is that there could be residents here in Oregon who work in other states, and they earn their earned income, say, like in Washington State, and they would then not be qualifying for this bill the way it is currently written. So that is kind of some of the issues surrounding this bill, it's specifying that either you have to look at both the federally adjusted gross income or the Oregon adjusted gross income, and whichever is greater then becomes the maximum income limit that cannot exceed 250% of the federal poverty level. And this begins tax years beginning on or after 2005.
Elizabeth, have you done any kind of a fiscal or a revenue analysis on this particular bill using the two scenarios, that is, from income from all sources and income from Oregon sources?
Yeah, Chairman Butler, basically what I have here in this last little bit on the background is I did get the Department of Revenue to sort through the Working Family Child Care Tax Credit and, you know, figure basically there was 28,202 returns in 2003. 93% of those are actually Oregon residents. So, clearly the majority of all these returns are Oregon residents. 7% then are non-residents and part-year residents. That really only amounts to about 1,247 non-resident returns. And those are the ones that Deborah will speak to as far as who they were trying to address in this bill. But really, the other issue is separating out then, you know, like you're saying, for the issue of the Oregon residents who earn their income in Washington State or some other state. We can't track where that income actually was earned. We don't have non-Oregon source income for a resident of the state of Oregon because we don't care. We tax it all the same.
So it really needs to be identified as that portion of income which is included in Oregon's taxable income versus all income from whatever source, wherever reportable, to be able to jump the high bar of the credit then.
Yeah, and Chairman Butler, what we may need to do is have this bill kind of separated out as far as residents versus non-residents.
Okay.
And then deal with it separately.
Deborah, would you like to just speak to it? Well, let's see. Bob, I know this is a priority bill, and as you say, you've got places to go before you sleep, so please. Bob?
Thank you, Chair Butler and members of the committee. For the record, Robert J. Castagna, representing the Oregon Catholic Conference. And thank you for taking this bill out of order, Mr. Chair. When we read this bill, we identified a problem which staff has outlined. We were involved in the creation of the Working Family Child Care Credit as well as the Earned Income Credit in the 1997 session. The basic thrust and purpose of the Working Family Child Care Credit is to help people stay in work, help to defray their child care expenses, and this was done at the same time as Oregon was moving its welfare program to encourage people to move from welfare to work. So this assists people to stay in the workplace and to take care of their child care expenses. What came to my mind when I read the language as printed in the bill, and I believe it's an unintended consequence, was from Oregon sources would appear to exclude that person from qualifying for the Working Family Child Care Credit who lives in Oregon but works maybe on one of our border states, Washington, Idaho, Nevada, California. That income clearly wouldn't be from an Oregon source, but it gets taxed in Oregon, and the intention is to help them defray their child care expenses. So bringing it up to staff and their discussion with the Department of Revenue, I think it's an unintended consequence, which the department would like to correct.
Okay, thank you. And Deborah?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, Deborah Buchanan, Department of Revenue. I apologize. I usually like to have a nice handout for you to look at while I talk, but I don't have that for this bill. But staff explained that the intent of what we were doing is we think perhaps that it was unintended that persons without earned income that is taxable by Oregon would be able to claim a refundable credit that really was intended to help them with costs of child care expenses that allow them to work. So this is sort of mirroring or matching up the earned income provision with the credit provision. And it would say that your earned income needs to be taxable, if we had an amendment, needs to be taxable by Oregon in order to qualify for the credit. An example of a person who can qualify under current law would be the Washington resident who works in Vancouver, who has no connection with Oregon except perhaps gain from installment sales on property. or they may have rental income in Oregon, but they're not working here, they're not living here, they don't have any connection except for that piece of income. Yet they're able to use their Washington job and their Washington child care expenses to claim this refundable credit on the Oregon return and offset maybe not only all of their tax, but receive a refund as well, because it can exceed their tax liability. Mm-hmm. So the question is whether you intended that result or not. And as mentioned, there does need to be an amendment to correct the problem that Mr. Castagna discovered.
Deborah, if you'll go ahead and plan to work with our staff and let's go ahead and develop some of the scenarios as to what these issues are, and then I'll work with you to develop the amendments to go ahead and get this taken care of. You'll work with Bob Castagna as well. So I would appreciate that, and that way we can continue to proceed forward. And colleagues, we'll go ahead and continue to post this bill. I think next Thursday we have some other Department of Revenue bills, and we'll plan to see that back then. Is that satisfactory? Questions or comments? Thank you very much. We're going to go ahead and close the public hearing portion on House Bill 2451. Thank Bob and Deborah for participating. And we're going to continue on. We're in a public hearing on 2448, House Bill 2448.
Elizabeth? Chairman Butler and committee members, with House Bill 2448. And what this is doing is dealing with refund amounts. And it's allowing the Department of Revenue now to refund amounts determined to be overpayments on original tax returns, which were filed more than 3 years after the due date. And it's just the way the statute is written, is that the Department of Revenue cannot give refunds if the original tax returns were filed more than 3 years after the due date. And so this is just clarifying how you'd like the refunds to be treated and to make it comparable with other tax returns. And so Deborah will go into examples of that. But basically, it's also limiting the tax refund amount to the amounts paid within 2 years from the date of the filing of the claim then for the refund. And so basically, the majority of your bill is right here in the first 22 lines of the first page. The rest of the bill then is conforming language there that that Legislative Council wanted to adhere to the legislative style. And then you've got Section 5 then is just really telling you the effective date of this measure, 91 days after the end of session. So this really won't have a revenue impact. At the most, you know, maybe a few more refunds would be given, but it's minimal, less than $50,000 per year. And there's no fiscal on those.
Thank you. Deborah?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Deborah Buchanan, Department of Revenue. The general rule is that a person has 3 years to file a claim for refund if they have overpaid their taxes. So 3 years from the due date, you can file a claim for refund, and we will send that to you. If you file your return on time, then you have the longer of 3 years or 2 years from the date you pay any tax. For example, let's assume that you paid, filed your return on time, discover a mistake just before the 3 years expires, you file an amended return and pay more tax. And then 18 months later, your accountant says, you know, that last CPA you had really didn't know what they were doing. You should never have paid that additional tax. Let's file an amended return and get that back. It's more than 3 years from the original due date, but you can file an amended return and get a refund of what you paid within the prior 2 years. That's the general rule. Now, what happens when a person doesn't file timely? If they file the original return outside that three-year window, then whether or not we can send them a refund under current law depends on whether or not they claim a refund on the return or whether they show tax to pay. If they ask for a refund, we can't refund anything, even amounts that were paid in the prior 2 years. However, if they show tax to pay and we adjust it so that it's a refund return, we can send them a refund of amounts paid in the prior 2 years. So you have these two situations where people are in pretty much exactly the same circumstances, but whether or not they get a refund depends on whether or not they asked for a refund. And it's just an anomaly in the statute that our attorneys pointed out to us, and we're thinking that that probably isn't what was intended. So this bill would allow a refund of amounts paid within the prior 2 years of the original filing. So they're both treated.
Of the original filing or the filing of an amendment?
Of the original filing, Mr. Chair. So if, for example, I have not filed my return yet, and I file my original return 4 years after the due date, but I made a payment to the department within the last 2 years.
On that original return?
On the original return. This would allow us to refund payments within 2 years of the filing.
Are the questions, as Governor indicates, this kind of clears up an anomaly of a problem that I've seen before in a practice. Representative Berger, you recognize?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Deborah, in the example you just gave, if they hadn't made any payment, even if it was determined they would have a refund, they wouldn't get it because they didn't pay any of it and you're 4 years out. Am I correct in that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Berger, you are correct on that, yes.
Okay. Other questions? colleagues, this appears to be clear on the face of it. Is there any questions that there may or may not be folks amongst our colleagues as this goes to the House? I'm going to ask you a question now. Is there a subsequent referral on this one yet?
Not that I've seen.
Okay. I didn't see any either, but I didn't see any on the ones the other day either. If this goes to the House, should this go to the consent calendar? I think we need to talk about that. It isn't a super complex issue compared to the things we will be dealing with. Okay. We'll go then into I'm going to have a work session on House Bill. Let's go ahead and explain the drawback to the committee. The drawback is when it goes to the consent calendar, it actually waits on the burner for 2 days versus moving it to the floor and having it spoken to. And if anybody wants to speak, you know, wildly throw your hand in the air. And otherwise, Paul, is there any other drawback to waiting 2 days, or is it?
The other drawback is obvious one, that there's no floor discussion if you want to have it here, there needs to be. But you have to wait 2 days to see if four representatives, any four representatives are on the committee or not, can
certainly
file and say that they want to have it heard. And then you're back to start the process again. But if you do recommend the due pass recommendation, send it to the floor, and we can process it today.
Okay.
So we can do it quicker, get it to the floor quicker if it's just 3 months or anything like
that. Hey, discussion?
Mr. Chair, floor is already backed up with bills we postponed today. Consent calendar makes the most sense to me, Mr. Chair.
That's what I'm thinking, is that even though it does back it up 2 days, if there are members of our colleagues in the House that have some angst over the fact that really we're just creating a more equitable situation for folks that are paying taxes within prior 2 years on returns that might be 4 years old, and then allowing that refund to occur, it doesn't appear to be something that would create a great deal of heartburn, but what turns accountants on and floats their votes, who knows. So with that, colleagues, we are in a work session for 2448. Chair recognizes.
Excuse me, Mr. Chair. We need to close the public hearing on the bill and then open.
Close the public hearing on House Bill 2448. Open a work session on 2448. Representative Berger.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2448 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
And the motion has been made to move 2448 to the House floor with a due pass recommendation. Any objections? Hearing and seeing none, so ordered.
Mr. Chair, I move that House Bill 2448 be placed on the consent calendar.
You've heard the motion. Is there any objection to moving House Bill 2448 onto the consent calendar of the House of Representatives? Hearing and seeing no objections, so ordered. We'll get a carrier then.
You're not on the consent, you don't have a carrier.
No, that's right. We don't. Okay. We'll close the work session on House Bill 2448. We'll open a public hearing on House Bill 2449. Elizabeth?
Okay. Chairman Butler and committee members, with House Bill 2449, this is a pretty straightforward bill. Basically, it's just allowing the Department of Revenue the flexibility to accept other methods of apportioning personal income tax refunds. Basically, this is dealing with the refunds for individuals that are filing a joint tax return. It requires that if an alternative method of distributing the tax refund besides just equal shares among the individuals filing the joint return, they all have to agree. They all have to agree to the alternative method of apportioning that tax refund. It's going to apply to alternative tax refund apportionments made after the effective date of this measure. So basically, under current law, if a married couple wants to split out their personal income tax refund, it must be split out proportional to the gross earnings then that you're seeing on the tax form. So basically, there's not any other alternative method, and this is just allowing the Department of Revenue that flexibility. There's no revenue impact to this. And
okay. Deborah Buchanan.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members of the committee, Deborah Buchanan, Department of Revenue. Mr. Chairman, we think this is another statute that perhaps hasn't kept up with other changes in Oregon law. The statute as it is written now allows the department to apportion refunds of withholding, and it doesn't specifically address refunds that may be made up of estimated tax payments or refunds of a refundable tax credit. So we think that when that was originally enacted, we didn't have estimated tax payment requirements for individuals, and obviously we didn't have a refundable tax credit at that time. So what House Bill 2449 would provide is that we can apportion refunds, period, whether they're made up of withholding or estimated tax or refundable credits. That's a cleanup provision. The other piece of it is that apportionment would be done by a 50-50 split. Unless the taxpayer's husband and wife both agree to a different method of apportionment, a different percentage. And we would accept that and honor that unless it's designed to avoid offset of a portion of the refund to a debt. For example, you may have one spouse that has a debt incurred prior to marriage, a student loan, child support debt, and they may want to apportion all of the refund to the non-debtor spouse in order to avoid that offset. They wouldn't be able to do that. This would say it's going to go 50-50, so half of that would go to the debt. The other half would go to the non-debtor spouse.
Deborah, the apportionment, the gross income apportionment, is that statutory, or is that just something that's evolved in time?
Mr. Chair, I believe the statute now requires that we look at wages and withholding.
Right, but we're on page 3, line 24, 25, 26, and 27, we're taking that out of the method, removing the withholding as the method to insert either the 50% rule or the apportionment, the refund apportionment based upon gross income. Again, the question is, Is the standard apportionment that we've always used that I've seen for a long time, is it statutory or is that something that's just evolved?
I believe it's statutory, Mr. Chair, because this is the language that we use to make the apportionment now. We look at the wages and the withholding.
Okay. So it bears everything on the return bears its proportionate share of to the income of each of the parties on a joint return.
That's my understanding.
And when it provides for, on line 31, 50% of the total, that's the default is what I'm understanding.
Mr. Chair, in this bill, that would be the default unless the taxpayers both agree to a different...
Okay, and it's justifiable under the apportionment method if there's offsets.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, Mr. Chair.
All right. So then I would. I'm coming back to the question then. If I've got a husband who has significant other debt, owes child support, and the husband is the wage earner, and he's going to have attached half of the, or he's going to have his entire refund because all of the withholding previously would have been the husband's. under this method, the maximum that short of filing an apportionment schedule by the taxpayers, then the wife is going to get half of the refund, even though the wife did not have withholding and may not have had gross income in reflected in the return.
Mr. Chair, that's correct. And we did have discussions in developing this concept about that very issue and whether or not it was appropriate that half that it would be split 50-50. And I'm not an attorney, but it's my understanding that there is a concept in domestic law about marital assets, assets that are acquired during a marriage and who contributes to those. I understand that when you have a married couple, each one is considered to have contributed to acquisition of assets. Any tax refund would be considered an asset. So even though you may have only one wage earner and one person with withholding, both parties have made contributions to that. And in that sense, it may make sense to split the refund 50-50.
So, Deborah, in your experience with the department, is it conceivable that there would be a time or the net amount of the times that it's happening that the exact scenario that I just explained to you, that the husband has prior debts by due through the Department of Justice, and most of the income, therefore, even in an apportionment situation, he would have been entitled to a greater than half, but that the maximum that the Department of Justice for the child support will only get half.
Mr. Chair, I believe that's correct. It would be a 50-50 split.
And do we see any concern about that being expressed by the child support folks, child support division over the Department of Justice?
I have not heard any concerns from them. We did have our attorneys look at the concept, but I don't know whether the child support attorneys looked at it, and I would be happy to follow up on that.
Representative Hass is recognized.
I'm on the same wavelength, Mr. Chair, that about the child support and the deadbeat dad. Say he remarries and he still has this judgment against him. What is the current policy then if he and his new wife have a refund coming? Then what happens then if there's this outstanding judgment?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hass, the statute would require that we look at the wages and the withholding and issue the refund based on that. If the debtor spouse has all of the wages and all of the withholding, then that person's refund would be used to offset that child support debt.
Even if there's a spouse along there too, or would you just figure out half of it, or
under this bill, or
it's a
current
joint
law?
Return under current law.
Sorry, Mr. Chair, Representative Hass. Under current law, we would look to who has the wages and who has the withholding. So if the husband has all of the wages and all of the withholding and the debt, the refund would go to offset the debt.
But if it's just, you know, like many households are just a jumble of different wages and investments and all kinds of factors, then how would you figure it out?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hass, again, I believe the statute would require us just to look at the wages and the withholding. And that's really one of the things that we're trying to address with House Bill 2449 is, as you pointed out, things are jumbled now. You have two wage earners, or you may have a wage earner and a business and rental property and investment income, one person making estimated payments, another making the withholding, and it can be difficult to calculate who's entitled to exactly what. So,
well, Mr. Chair,
yes.
Anxiety here is that wouldn't this bill allow someone who has one of these judgments you're comfortable that he couldn't try to lessen the impact of that judgment through this change?
Let's
try to escape it.
Let's just do this. So we've got Wanda Eichhoff here from the Child Support Division, Department of Justice. Wanda, can you come forward, please? Enter and sign in here. We've got your name. Can you just give us some kind of an idea of the concerns that we've got here?
Mr. Chairman, My name is Wanda Eickhoff, and I'm here on my day off. I'm as a private citizen, but I do work for Department of Justice Division of Child Support, and I do, my job is I process money that's received on tax intercepts as an accounting person, and currently we intercept on any case where the arrears balance exceeds $500, and according to the current laws, if the money that is on a tax return is earned 100% by the person who owes the child support, then the other spouse who didn't have any earnings can't claim part of that refund.
And that's the current statute that we're talking about online.
Correct.
24 through 27 of this particular bill, and that would basically go away.
And if I'm understanding what's being read here today, this bill would allow 50% of that refund to be claimed by the injured spouse.
Well, it wouldn't even be, have to be claimed after this passage. If this bill were to pass, then automatically 50% would go to the second spouse that had no income or potentially had no income and withholdings.
And this would be on Oregon revenue intercepts, correct?
It's my understanding that presently the intercepts would follow the current law, and that is that on a joint return, you would look to the whoever earned the gross income and who had the withholdings.
Right. And I'm not speaking on behalf of the Department of Justice because I'm not here as a spokesperson for them, but when that money's receipted, it's applied to debt of the custodial parent. And federal tax intercept money goes to state debt first before it goes to the family, but Oregon revenue money, when it's intercepted, goes directly to the family first.
But by the same token, Wanda, if we had a deadbeat dad that wasn't working and the income earned on that joint return was that was earned and reflected in the joint return was the wife's income, then there would be no intercept at that particular stage, would there?
Well, if they file a joint return, okay, and it's intercepted because his Social Security number is on the return, then there's a process called an injured spouse where they can the earner who doesn't owe the child support can file a claim to.
In the meantime, the Department of Justice holds up and receives the refund. Is that correct?
Well, there's a process for that to be taken care of, and they can call us and take care of it. But the bill, the way that I'm just deeply concerned that the way that I'm hearing it today is going to take away half of it for the person who might owe it. And again, I'm speaking as a private citizen. I'm not speaking on the part of the revenue, but I couldn't sit back there when you were asking those questions and not say anything.
Thank you, Wanda. We appreciate your testimony, and it probably bears fruit that we need to hear from the Department of Justice on this particular issue. I also have one other concern, Deborah, with regard to this, and that is, could a couple, in effect, actually thwart the meaning and intention of this particular bill by offering additional estimated payments above and beyond what would ever be imaginary as to an amount that would have to be paid, and then come back and go to the default 50% of the amount refunded to go to the to go to the innocent spouse, and thus we've been able to convert joint funds into the innocent spouse in effect, and the deadbeat dad, and this using our example, has only had to pay half of the amount. I'm concerned about that unintended consequence as well.
Mr. Chair, I think you've raised a valid point, because the determination of whether or not it's to avoid an offset is on the request by the spouse.
Right. It's a 50-50 until you have that.
Exactly.
And under that scenario, they've intentionally attempted to try and evade the attempt to pay out for the other obligation, and so by paying an additional $10,000 in estimated tax to the state of Oregon when they knew they were going to have a refund from their W-2s anyway, that would be a way of locking that resource up. It's not in their bank account. The Department of Revenue is holding it until they get ready to file a tax return, at which time All of the withholdings would be divided in two, and the estimated tax would be divided in two, and the deadbeat spouse, the deadbeat dad in this case, continuing on with our example, would then have been able to successfully convert the $5,000 or the $10,000, and I'm assuming that because we're using him as the working spouse, then we've converted half of his withholding that would have been required to be refunded, the portion that would be required refunded, plus half of the estimated tax, and we've successfully re-anointed that to be wife, in this case, the wife's refund, not subject to any kind of intercept. So, Deborah, while we're in public hearing, I'm going to ask that you go back to the Department of Justice for their intercept group and have them work with us on this and maybe develop some scenarios. Other questions? Yes, Sir. Representative Riley is recognized.
Being a freshman at this and not understanding some things.
Representative Riley, the only bad question is the one that we don't get asked.
Right.
So all questions are valid and good, and you seem to be an expert at asking the good questions.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. But what I'm wondering is what takes precedence, this bill or a judgment of the court?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Riley, I am not absolutely sure about that. I would not want to say that we are going to disregard a judgment of the court. So it would be.
I'd like to know the answer to that.
Okay.
That's an excellent question, and chances are that this would become the law and therefore would become statutory, and maybe a judge would be bound by it, even though it might create an inequitable situation. And I'm concerned about that, and that's why we're asking Deborah Buchanan to take this up with the Department of Justice, and then please get back with us, and perhaps we can go to a meeting, Deborah, when you get the information.
Glad to do that.
We'll work on that.
Mr.
Yes,
Chair?
Yes, Wanda.
Could I make one comment?
You bet. We've got time for one comment.
For those of us that work in the Division of Child Support, the proportion of non-paying parents is growing constantly to be larger percentage of women that are non-paying as to 15% to 20%, and so we call them the non-paying parent rather than a deadbeat dad.
You're politically correct.
Thank you, Juan.
In Oregon, when we step in behind the cow, we just call it what it is.
And so we take a lot of flack for that term. So, Mr. Chair, if you could please.
Mea culpa, and you're welcome to go ahead and slap me around a little later.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you very much. Colleagues, with that, we are going to go ahead and close the public hearing. Close the public hearing on 2449. And we are now, colleagues, we have before us a work session on introduction of legislative concepts. Paul, come forward, and we are going to now go into work session for the purpose of session introduction of legislative concepts.
Mr. Chair, these are two LCs I would not envision as being on the consent calendar.
That having been said.
If the committee approves them at some future time. The first one is LC 1955. It is actually from the Department of Revenue, but prepared in anticipation of the committee's taking up the issue of reconnection to changes in the IRS code. And this is, of course, one of the elements in your work plan for the session. It is a complicated federal law. We have found some other issues that probably should be looked at in terms of conformity with federal law, and that would be also fit with under this discussion. But LC 1955 is the major reconnect bill.
Colleagues, we don't expect that, number one, you're going to dig through LC 1955, nor do we anticipate that you have to agree with everything that's in there. However, most of the items that have been identified by the Department of Revenue are issues which are relative to the reconnection of Oregon's income tax structure with that of the federal government, and we've got some issues of rolling reconnect and some automatic disconnect. And so at this time, Representative Comp.
Okay, I move that LC 1955, and that's all I know. Be submitted as a committee bill.
You've heard the recommendation and motion of...
At
the request of the Department of Revenue. I beg your pardon.
At the request of the Department of Revenue.
You've heard the motion by Representative Comp. Is there any dissension from that motion? Any negatives? With that, we were going to go ahead and introduce LC 1955 as a committee bill on behalf of the House Committee on Revenue. Paul, LC 2363.
Mr. Chair, LC 2363 deals with the restructuring of the education service districts in the state. It has a number of changes in those districts and their relationship to school districts. And it does change the percentages of the state school fund that would be going to the ESDs versus going to the school districts directly. So that's LC 2363.
Questions? Representative Hass, did you want to contribute anything at this time?
No, other than this is the ESD consolidation bill that I'm glad we can do as a committee bill as opposed to individual sponsors or sponsorettes. Because
it
deadbeat dad
non-participating sponsors.
It will take Democrats and Republicans and urban and rural and outliers and inliers to work to do this, and I think we will do this when it's all said and done, and so I'm glad that we can do this as a committee bill.
Thank you very much. Representative Hass now moves LC 2363 be introduced as a committee bill on behalf of the House Revenue Committee. Are there any objections to that introduction? Hearing and seeing none, so ordered. Colleagues, that finishes the business for the day. If we could plan to, today's Wednesday, tomorrow's Thursday, we get Friday off.
Yes.
Next week we start at 1 o'clock even time. So with that, thank you very much. Being no further business, we'll close for the day.